Morning, everyone. The Minnesota House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. The clerk will take the roll of attendance.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Leading into the weekend.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Novotny. Present.
Representative O'Neill.
Present.
Representative Pinto.
Present. Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang, excused. That concludes roll call with 18 present.
Very well. Quorum is established. This committee hearing is being held consistent with House Rule 10.01. The public can view that that rule on the Minnesota website. That's a rule that allows for hearings in virtual space, if you will. The public could also visit the committee webpage, or rather, yes, the committee page of this committee on the Minnesota House website to view instructions on how to view these proceedings via streaming video, as well as instructions for participating in public testimony. Good morning, members. Today we've got a number of good bills. I'm looking forward to a good conversation on them, all under the theme of Corrections Reform Day today. So the first bill up, and I understand that the Department of Corrections is with us, but they're pulling double duty today, as apparently there's also the Senate hearing going on as well. So we'll be mindful of that and see if we can calibrate our questions and answers and engagement with the department accordingly. Members, the first bill, we have five bills. This committee has been pretty efficient in moving through legislation, and I hope that we can do that again today. Brief reminder that next Friday we will have an extended period of time to hear quite a few number of bills, so please plan your calendar accordingly. We're looking to have a period of time beyond our present time to take us out to 2:30 on Friday. It certainly is my hope that if we don't have to go to 2:30, we won't. But I just want to make sure that we've reserved the time in this video, virtual platform for us to be able to do that, maintaining our constant commitment to have committee hearings be publicly accessible. The first bill today is the Chair's Bill, House File 1369, regarding establishing an indeterminate sentence release board. And so the Chair will move to refer House File 1369 to the General Register. Members, this bill, rather currently under Minnesota law, there are certain statutes that establish a supervised release possibility for those serving a mandatory life sentence. We currently have just under 500 people serving life with possibility of parole in our prison systems. Right now, under Minnesota law, the commissioner has the sole authority to make a decision regarding release of these individuals. That puts us in a pretty rare group of states. There's only four states where the commissioner is making these decisions. alone as opposed to a panel making decisions. So the norm across the nation is to have a panel of individuals, and there's different ways in which those are set up. In 37 states, the governor has the authority to make an appointment to the parole board or the releasing authority, whatever title and mechanism that they use. Under this proposal, a indeterminate sentence release board is created. It will be made up of five members, including the commissioner of corrections, and the governor will appoint the other four members after receiving recommendations from both the majority and minority leaders of each legislative body. And of course, you know, the commissioner, or rather the governor, appoints with Senate approval, you know, the commissioner of corrections. And so that is also, you know, in the governor's authority. The bill has technical pieces that provide for terms, for compensation, for the duties, limitations, and requires a report due to the relevant legislative committees. And then finally, the bill establishes that a majority vote of those members present would be required to place a resident on supervised release. Members, we heard this bill last session. It was part of our omnibus bill, and obviously was not, you know, negotiated to completion, you know, with the other body. So it's back here again this year, and I'm looking forward to the conversation. We do have testifier, and the testifier is the Commissioner of Corrections, Commissioner Schnell. So I'm going to ask the commissioner to come forward, identify himself, tell us more about the bill, and then stand ready for questions and discussions with the committee. So with that, Commissioner Schnell.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Again, pleasure to be here and to talk about this bill again. As you mentioned, we have had some robust conversation about this measure previously. And I think it remains one of our priorities. I would just say that, you know, for those who have not been heard of this bill before, or new members of the committee, right now people who are subject to parole, and generally speaking, in our state today, under today's law, if people have the possibility of parole, they would serve a mandatory minimum 30-year term. And procedurally, beginning about year 27, they come before the commissioner and a panel, which is a group of advisors and DOC staff, largely that assist in that process. And ultimately, it is the responsibility of the commissioner to either grant parole or set a term of continuance for reconsideration of parole at a later date. I will tell you from a personal standpoint, I take this on as a very significant responsibility and take it very seriously, as it should be. These are people who have been convicted of crimes that in our state that have warranted a life sentence, which statutorily is a 30-year term of incarceration. As was mentioned, we have, nearly 600 people in our correctional facilities that do have life sentences with the possibility of parole today. We have a whole variety of requirements, administrative rules, and items by law that are considered as part of the process, including consultation and often personal meetings with surviving family members of victims, and in most of these cases, which is an incredible experience in and of itself. Statutorily, these decisions have to be made. And I think that becomes important. What we want to make sure is that we have a process that ensures a consistency and a level of objectivity on making parole decisions. Because over the years, there's been significant differences in the approaches and interpretation of the way parole decisions were being made. To illustrate the decisions, we looked at a period of time of 20 years to look at this. And over the term of three different commissioners prior to me, they reviewed roughly the same number of individuals for parole, but granted them at far different rates, one at 8.8%, one at 12.7%, and one at 32%. So you can see that just one commissioner was responsible for almost two-thirds of life sentence individuals being granted parole. This is not an indictment of any administration. It highlights the challenges that are presented when making these decisions and when they fall to one person. And what this measure does is it establishes that intermediate sentence review release board, which will be made up of five qualified individuals, four of which are appointed by the governor. And after two recommendations are each made by the House majority and minority leaders of the House and Senate, along with the commissioner of corrections who would serve as the board chair. So it simply expands who conducts and makes these release decisions and who is not eligible for review. And what this does, we think, is really a fair and balanced approach that really is a matter of shared governance, which we think becomes important. A panel approach to decision-making also has the potential of reducing bias, increasing the diversity of perspective, and strengthening the understanding of correctional policy, resulting in more fair and equitable processes. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for carrying this bill, for authoring this bill, and for the committee's time and consideration. And I'm happy to take any questions that people may have.
Very well, thank you, Commissioner. There are no amendments, and there are no other testifiers, and so let's go to a discussion, and first we have Representative O'Neill. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we have talked about this in the past, and I had concerns then. I have the same concerns now. I don't necessarily disagree with having a panel. My concerns lie really in a couple specific lines within the bill. And one of them is that this vote would happen of a majority of those actually present. That to me seems very problematic. If we're going to discuss the gravity of someone that has committed this grievous of a crime and grave of a crime, and it's only a majority of those present. So if one person is missing or two people are missing, then that shifts the dynamics considerably. Now, maybe that'll never happen, I don't know, but that's what the language of the bill says. The majority of those present. Furthermore, I have a concern that there isn't a higher bar when we're talking about, again, the severity of a crime, that it isn't a supermajority or a unanimous vote of those five. So those are a couple of my concerns. In reading through the bill, I actually have another question that I didn't have before, because it talks about the governor being able to appoint. And I realize that he'll have a list of recommendations from the legislature. But can he depart from that list and appoint someone else? And I guess that's a question for the author.
Representative O'Neill, if the language is not clear, we can certainly clarify that the intent is that the governor makes appointments after conferring with the different leaders. It doesn't say that his decisions or her decisions are limited to that. It's meant to be a transparent engagement with leadership of our bodies to receive their wisdom. But you know, the governor is elected by the state, by the people of the state of Minnesota, and he or she is as a result entrusted with making lots of decisions What the intent here is to make sure that whatever decisions are being made, in this case, the determination of this board, that it can only be made after having conferred with the leaders of the respective bodies. I can call on Representative, or rather Commissioner Snell, answer the first two points. I would point out that a majority means three people. So it isn't one person and his or her biases, you know, it's three people. And so there is, at least as a minimum, and so then there's a check, if you will, of the meeting of minds of three individuals, most likely three individuals that will have, if not all of them, I would suspect many of them having the trust, if you will, and confidence of the two legislative bodies. I don't think that's inappropriate at all. I would also argue that three people is a higher bar than one person applying his or her, you know, sole, you know, objective or subjective decision making. But I'll call on the commissioner to either correct me or to further answer, respond to your inquiry. Commissioner.
So thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill. You know, I understand, certainly understand in a very personal way the gravity of the decision that gets made. But I would also, I would agree with the chair that you know, today that rests with one person, and adding additional reviewers, adding additional perspectives to this body, is I would argue a better, more expansive look at these decisions and what goes into them. I happen to, based on being in the position of having to make those decisions, I don't know that a supermajority changes anything. I think it ultimately should be a majority of the people who are there. And I can tell you that no one wants to be wrong in making these decisions. And so for me, I think that majority, and again, I understand of those present, I would certainly hope that you know, the people who are involved in this would be present at the vast majority of those meetings. But you know, I understand that point. However, today that's a one person decision.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Schnell. I mean, the commissioner and I have talked about this in the past, and again, I'm not necessarily opposed to having a board. My concern is because of the severity of the crime, we're talking about a life that was taken that will never, that you can't undo that. We just want to make sure that that is the right decision. And in my mind, you know, if there's two objecting to that, then that gives me pause, because that person could still be released. The governor doesn't even have a veto power in this if he feels that this is not the right decision. I think there needs to be a bit of a higher bar, whether it's a supermajority, so four of the five, or the governor having veto power or something. Again, I'm not opposed to the idea of having a board. But on a very practical matter, I just looked at the path in the Senate, and I apologize that I keep bringing this up, but we are at second deadline. And, well, there's a couple issues. So you have a fiscal note of about $40,000, and we're sending it to the general register. I'm concerned that it's bypassing Ways and Means. I'm also concerned that in the Senate, so if we're sending this to the general register in the Senate, it hasn't had a hearing that I can see, but I recognize that the Senate's website isn't always accurate, and it's under maintenance for this entire time. So I don't know if they had a hearing and laid it over. I don't know. But I know that it's still in the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee there. So my concern is the path. I'm concerned that it's going straight to the General Register and not making a stop in Ways and Means, since it does have a fiscal impact. So those are some of my outstanding concerns. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. And on your second point, I do find validity with that concern. And I'll turn to the commissioner here quickly, but I'm certainly amenable to amending my motion that it goes to Ways and Means. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I would only say at this stage that the you know, we have done very early presentation of our budget. This was included to the Senate. That was at least it was included in our budget proposal at the time. We did not talk you know, specifically about the full range of the details of that, but this measure would be included in that budget.
Very well, thank you, Commissioner. Representative Johnson?
Chair Mariani, Commissioner Schnell, I want to thank you for the work you do. I know this is very difficult decisions for you to make dealing with these releases. I'm just wondering, when you have these come up, are you contacting staff and meeting with staff, getting as much information as possible?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, absolutely. There's each person has a significant file, and we are provided myself and the other panelists who are the advisors are provided all of that information, psychological reviews, community impact investigations, victim input, support letters, I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents on each case. And then we have wardens and there is a program review team that meets with that person prior to that. They provide input as well, along with a psychologist. So it is a very comprehensive process. And I think, you know, one of the key issues here is that, is this a correctional decision that is being made, or is this ultimately a political decision? And I think this is one of the tough challenges. I understand that, you know, we have perspectives that may be aligned in one way or another politically. At the same time, I think, you know, certainly for me and the input that I receive, these are really correctional decisions that have to be made, and they're made in line with public safety being first and foremost as part of that decision.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Commissioner Schnell, I understand it's a heavy burden on you, but I believe that's the way it's designed to be, because you are the one that knows what's going on. You're hearing what's going on all the time. You understand if there's some issues that have come up in the past while you were a commissioner, you will remember if that person was involved in it. I think that's the way it was designed. I know it's difficult, but by having it as just the one person, it generally leaves the political decisions out of it, where it can get to a board, it can get more political. So I think the best way to do it is the best way we have right now. So I have a tough time supporting this at this time. But like I say, I appreciate the work you do, but it unfortunately, this is one of the toughest duties you have.
Appreciate the inquiry, Representative Johnson. I see no further questions or comments. And so the chair then will amend his motion to refer House File 1369 to the committee on Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Johnson, nay. Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist? Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel?
No.
Representative Grossel, nay. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative Lucero, nay. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Representative Mueller, nay. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Representative Novotny, nay. Representative O'Neill?
Hill, no.
Representative O'Neill, nay. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
No.
Representative Poston, nay. Representative Raleigh?
Nay.
Representative Raleigh, nay. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Zhang, excused. That concludes roll call with 10 ayes and 8 nays.
Very well. Of all the 10 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails. And House File 1369 is referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Next up is House File 1448. Representative Johnson, that's your bill. And I believe your motion is to refer 1448 to the General Register. We're going to be laying this over for possible inclusion as we move forward over the next couple of weeks. So Representative Johnson moves to refer House File 1448 to the General Register. Representative Johnson, your bill is before us.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, members. First of all, before we get started, I do have a DE amendment that was worked on very diligently between Commissioner Snell's staff and our staff, and it's, I believe, a very good DE amendment.
Very well. Representative Johnson moves the DE1 amendment, and Representative Johnson, I take it voice vote is fine here?
That would be fine.
Very well. All in favor of the DE one amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And for House File 1448 as amended is before us. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, I'm going to briefly go through this. I believe Commissioner Snell is going to talk about it as well. The couple years ago, we had the OLA report, which was not a good report. It was, I'd have to say it was horrendous. The legislature is ultimately the ones responsible for what's happened in our correction facilities. And one of the recommendations from the OLA report was inspections or some type of more oversight of the correction system. In doing some research, we found out there is some inspections going on, but I think it was 2013, the last time that Rush City Prison was inspected, according to the OLA report. And so what this does is lets the legislature know what's going on better. It sets up a commission to do biennial reports to give to the legislature that are due in the second year of the biennium. And I specifically chose the second year. So if it's policy issues that need to be discussed from this report, we can deal with them on that year. But if it's financial issues, it gives us time to prepare for the budget year, which is coming up the next session. This commission would be under the Department of Corrections. It's a facility security and audit group consisting of the a DOC employee assigned to the Department of Corrections that does the inspections, an omnibus person of corrections, an elected sheriff nominated from the Minnesota State Sheriff's Association, appointed by the Commissioner of Corrections, a physical plant safety consultant appointed by the governor, a private security consultant with expertise in correctional facilities securities appointed by the governor, and then four legislators appointed by the majority and minority of each body. This gives us a good balance, a better understanding of what's going on in the prisons. Every year, and Commissioner Snell has done this as well, gives us an update, but it's from his side of what he sees. We've all had employees of the department contact us with things are going a little different. And we've also had inmates contact us with another side of the story, but where this commission would get together, they'd take a look at everything and provide a detailed report to this body and give us a better understanding of what's going on and giving us better oversight of what's going in that committee. Again, I would like to thank Commissioner Snell and his staff for working on this. We had a great meeting a couple weeks ago. And this past week, his staff has worked feverishly after we heard this bill was coming up to put this together. And I think it's a very good bill. Give the legislature some serious oversight that we need, that we are responsible for. But allow the commissioner also plan better and help us plan with him for the things that need to get done in our correction facility. And with that, Commissioner Snow has anything to say, I'd turn it over to him at this time.
Very well, Representative Johnson. Commissioner Snow.
Again, I want, Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Johnson, we thank you for the opportunity to work with you on this. You know, we think that ultimately, just given the attention that's being placed on correctional facilities, obviously the OLA report created major concerns for members as well as the department. We do have a plan to address some of that with some of the in our budget bill, which adds some inspection capabilities, which I know would ultimately be supported, would be doing these audits as directed by this these review groups. I would say that as we look at the audits, they're in general, we have large scale, broad agreement. We do have some like limited concerns because of some of the security information. Remember that these security audits include everything. They include sensitive information, including door and key, lock locations, numbers, emergency response protocols, emergency equipment, tool controls, tunnel locations, and so forth. And so some of that information is obviously highly protected. This group would obviously have access to that. We know that the bill would ultimately allow for that to remain, that security information to remain confidential. The outside folks that are appointed, the sheriff is no issue at all. I would just say that one concern we do have and how we would make sure that we obtain an appointed person from a security perspective or a physical, more of a physical plant security or safety person might be a bit more challenging to recruit through the traditional open appointments process and is a set of expertise that I think is demanded here that may require us to procure that, which is not something that we're opposed to. It's just something that we may have to go out and actually contract for that because of the nature of the expertise that's going to be required in these reviews. But on the whole, we think that we want to make sure that we're being transparent. We want to make sure that we're doing the best we can around safety and security and having a level of transparency that still maintains the high level of confidentiality around security data that may be collected and or exposed during the course of these audits.
Very well, thank you. Commissioner, it sounds like appropriate concerns, but not insurmountable in terms of how we would walk through and think through and process bringing individuals in. We have questions and comments, members. Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for the work on this. I know that this was originally offered as an amendment to the bill I brought forward dealing with the oversight and improved standards for county facilities. I think this is an important work to do as well for looking into our prisons. I appreciate the DE. I do share the concerns that the commissioner raised, and I'm hopeful that we can continue to work on those and see if we can address those going forward, because I do think there's a path to reach agreement, and I think we're close, if not quite there yet.
Very well. Any other members? If not, Representative Johnson?
Chair Mariani, members, when we're going through this and doing this DE amendment, one of the major concerns I had was especially the security data and all the data that's collected. That's why it's a very limited who we went through to get on this board or commission. And I believe that we can work out those last two issues pretty easily with the requirements that are put on there. We know that we need to make sure that that data is very much protected. It would not change classification. And it's something that I have no problem working with. You have to remember that these people are also appointed by the governor, so he can make sure that those people that are appointed are highly qualified.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Johnson. I do think the bill rises to the level of the that the report that we heard last year, expects of the legislature, and not just only, with our jail facilities, but also with our state facilities. I think it's an appropriate thing, and I know that we often struggle with these data classification issues and security issues. We've had a number of other bills that have also struggled with those, but nonetheless have moved forward pretty strongly. Most recently, the discussion around the Missing and Murdered Women's Task Force Group. It's just important to always get that on the table. And as I said earlier, work hard, to not make those insurmountable barriers. But thank you for your bill. We're going to have some time to continue to tweak, that particular issue as the chair will be laying over House File 1448. So with that, the chair lays over House File 1448 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Members, next up is House File 1761, Representative Hollins. Representative Hollins moves to refer House File 1761 to the Judiciary Committee. And Representative Hollins, I believe you have an author's amendment as well. Do you wish to move that?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to move my author's amendment.
Very well. Representative Hollins, your bill is before us, and as such, Representative Hollins moves adoption of the DE2 amendment. And I will admit, I haven't looked at the amendment yet. Is this just an author's? I tell you, it's just an author's amendment that puts the bill in the shape that you wish it to be before us. Is that correct?
That's correct. We had a bit of a rush trying to make sure we got through the revisers in time, and so we submitted the language, knowing full well that I was going to submit an amendment to correct the language while we work with stakeholders to get more precise.
That's very helpful. Thank you. Representative Johnson, you okay with a voice vote on this?
Yes, I am.
Very well. All in favor, members, all in favor of the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and House File 1761 is amended with the DE2 amendment. Representative Hollins, your bill is before us in the way you wish it to be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. This bill was written with the belief and understanding that we can come to a bipartisan solution to reduce the carceral state while still maintaining public safety and security. In recent years, Republicans and Democrats nationwide have united around criminal justice reforms related to probation. There are a couple of reasons why. Instead of sending low-risk offenders to prison, probation allows them the chance to remain in their community, which keeps family structures together. It makes workers available to the workforce, and it allows offenders to be rehabilitated. Furthermore, probation allows offenders to keep jobs and earn income, which makes it more likely for them to remain a positive force in their community. And probation is significantly cheaper than incarceration. And with the proper use of probation and proper personalization, we do believe that it can be a cost-effective form of rehabilitation. If people commit a crime, they should be held accountable. But often people under probation supervision are incarcerated for non-criminal technical violations, like not contacting their probation agent. Though the data regarding technical violations is incomplete and difficult to collect, this bill takes a step forward to ensure that people in probation are not sent to prison for their first technical violation. This bill was proposed by the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act counties to provide assurance that policies CCA jurisdictions have in place are being followed, and that revocation is not an available sanction for a single violation of the enumerated conditions that are listed in the bill. It's really intended to strike a balance between providing responsive probation that's tailored to the risk and need of the individual client and ensuring that the court hold probation agencies accountable for following evidence-based practices by not approving revocation requests for a single technical violation. We believe that correctional treatment is better provided through community resources than through confinement. So in situations where someone on probation has violated one of the enumerated provisions and does not present a public safety risk, a probation officer cannot automatically execute a sentence or take them into custody. These technical violations include alcohol use, drug use, curfew violations, failure to report to a probation agent, and any crime that would be considered a petty misdemeanor, like traffic violations. In order to execute a sentence for a first instance of one of these violations, the court must receive a written report showing probable cause to believe the person violated probation, and by establishing a preponderance of the evidence that the continued presence of the person in the community would present a risk to public safety. If a probation agent cannot state why they reasonably believe the person is a risk to public safety while remaining in the community, they will have an opportunity to consider alternative sanctions. I have two testifiers here today to speak to this bill. I believe it's Catherine Johnson from MACAC and Will Cooley from Decarcerate Minnesota Coalition.
Very well, thank you, Representative Hollins. And so let's, I don't know who's going to go first here. Perhaps the person you indicated, who his or her name again is?
I believe it's Catherine Johnson from MACAC. We had two originally.
I'm sorry, I'm shoveling up a bunch of paper here, and so I should be paying closer attention as I look through the documents of this bill. Catherine Johnson from MACAC, if you can come forward, state your name for the record and give us your testimony, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Catherine Johnson. I am the Legislative Committee Co-Chair for the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties and the Director of the Hennepin County Department of Community Corrections and Rehabilitation. I am here today on behalf of MACAC. The Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties, or MACAC, represents 34 Minnesota counties that have chosen to provide probation and supervised release services under the Community Corrections Act. MACAC counties can provide community supervision to more than 70% of those on probation or supervised release in the state of Minnesota. I want to begin by thanking Representative Hollins for her work on this bill and her commitment to creating a policy that balances public safety and rehabilitation. Over the last 10 years, probation practice in Minnesota and nationally has changed dramatically. While no system is perfect, community corrections professionals across all three delivery systems in Minnesota strive to provide support and services for our clients through the use of evidence-based practices. While we certainly have a role in enforcing court conditions, our purpose and our goal is to provide rehabilitative services and targeted interventions that reduce recidivism and support clients in a way that prevents future involvement in the justice system while improving community safety. Our agents work with clients to help them achieve success by assessing underlying reasons for their justice system involvement, facilitating access to resources to address those issues, including transportation, housing, employment, education, and treatment, and supporting our clients' efforts at behavior change. Most clients move through the supervision process without violations. Others do not. For those who struggle, our agents try to file a formal violation report as a last resort. There are often many sanctions conferences or violations of probation prior to any request to the court for revocation of a stay of sentence. That said, we also recognize this is not always the case. We understand that probation agents are not perfect and are subject to the same stresses as other criminal justice professionals. This bill would provide an additional way to ensure that minor violations that do not have significant public safety implications do not result in revocation and commitment to prison as a first step. It requires a higher standard of review by judges of recommendations from probation to ensure that those recommendations are consistent with evidence-based practices. It also allows our agents to use discretion in instances that do pose a significant risk to public safety. One example here might be a domestic abuse situation that is intertwined with substance abuse. Treatment is always the best option, but safeguards need to be in place for victims in the event of relapse by the client. We know that for some, this bill does not go far enough, and for others, it goes too far. We recognize that it may not be perfect, but hope to continue to work on the language with Representative Hollins and our other stakeholders as this bill continues through the legislative process. Also with me today is Mitch Christensen, the other co-chair of the MACAC Legislative Committee and director of 6W Community Corrections in West Central Minnesota. We both thank you for your attention, and we will remain on the call for any questions you might have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Appreciate your testimony and your work, as well as that of Mr. Christensen. Next, we have Will Cooley of Decarcerate Minnesota. If you can come forward, state your name for the record and give us your testimony, we'd appreciate that.
Chair Mariani, members of the committee, my name is Will Cooley, and I represent the Decarcerate Minnesota Coalition. So let's get right to it. Technical violations are a costly and a measure and do not often contribute to enhancing public safety. They're a major cause of criminal justice dysfunction. In 2017, 65% of prison admissions in Minnesota were for supervision violations. These violators are warehoused for a short time and re-released without having underlying issues addressed. The stint in prison creates disruptions in people's lives, exacerbates reentry challenges, and increases recidivism. Long periods of incarceration for non-crimes can cause people to lose their jobs, homes, and even custody of their children. The effort to reform technical violations came from the grassroots. Incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people put this issue at the top of our agenda. And to help craft these reforms, we've engaged stakeholders across the state, including DOC officials, prison guards, supervision agents, judges, and prosecutors. For example, we reached out to Violence Free Minnesota, statewide coalition working to end relationship abuse. In a survey of their membership, 82% supported technical violations reform. We also presented at reentry coalitions. Many service providers expressed support and spoke of their frustrations in working with clients only to see them sent to prison on technical violations. When they get out, the providers have to start all over with housing, employment, treatment programs, etc. As many of you know, the racial disparities for Native Americans in probation revocations are off the charts. We have received feedback from the Northwest Indian Community Development Center, and they have laid out a path to community corrections that stresses local accountability. But they need the resources that are currently going to warehousing people and churning them in and out of prison. This bill is one of the first steps towards ending mass incarceration by de-emphasizing punishment and reinvesting in people. It incentivizes the use of community resources to find solutions and prevent crime. As the bill states, revocation should only be used as a last resort. As Representative Holland said, this is not a partisan issue. 30 states have already passed technical violations reforms, including Alabama, Mississippi, and Utah. There's no reason Minnesota can't join them. Finally, we'd like to thank Representative Hollins and Representative O'Neill for putting forth bills on technical violations. People on supervision do not have well-heeled lobbyists. They cannot vote. They have made mistakes, to be sure, but they often have been dealt a difficult hand in life. In short, these representatives, O'Neill and Hollins, have acted on behalf of the least of us, and we ask you to join their cause and pass their bills. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cooley. Your sharing of the impact on our prisons evoked for me several conversations I had with both guards and residents at Stillwater over several visits, within the last couple of years. And this issue almost always came up, and it came up in sort of really practical ways. It's like, Representative, stop sending us those people. You know, I mean, they're disruptive. They're only here for a short time. They're not going to participate in anything meaningful. And they just really get in the way of the work that we have to do, either as guards or residents who are looking to, have a meaningful rehabilitative, corrections process. So I find a lot of powerful truth in what you shared here with us today. Representative Holland said that's all I have for testifiers. So we do. So let's move into a discussion with the committee, and we'll begin with Representative O'Neill. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hollins, for the bill. The DE was quite expansive. Your initial bill was just a couple paragraphs, and this is over four pages. So I'm trying to get up to speed to the changes that you've made. One concern I see that's consistent from the original bill to this bill is that, let me back up. So the bill that I've done and the bills I've done in the past, it doesn't order the court to do this or do that. And my concern here is that we're actually tying the court's hands and telling them again that the court must or may not. In this case, it's the court may not. I have a concern with that. In all the bills that I've drafted in all these years, I haven't done that with the court. And so I have a concern there. I also wonder, and I'm wondering if maybe one of the testifiers or maybe even if Commissioner Schnell is still on the line, if you could speak to how often does somebody actually have their probation or conditional release revoked for one technical violation? In my studies, it's fairly rare. It seems that probation officers are pretty understanding, and they become more and more understanding to try to restructure or to try to seek treatment. And so I'm really curious why it says just one technical violation, because at least in my experience, that isn't really who's ending up back into jail or prison. So I'm wondering if maybe Commissioner Schnell or if the author knows the actual statistics of admissions into either jail or prison or the revocations based on one technical violation, especially of this type of the lower level technicals.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Let's begin with the author, Representative Holland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill. That's a great question, and it really gets to the crux of what a lot of our discussions with stakeholders have been around. There, by all accounts from MACAC, there is not, people are not frequently having their, being put into prison for a single violation. Technically, or typically, that is not what happens, although technically they could. And so what this really seeks to do, in my understanding, is to codify that this shall not happen for this single violation. We don't, as far as I know, MACAC does not have all the statistics on this, and nobody really has the statistics on it precisely, because there are times when somebody will, when a probation officer will not report it or not ask for the revocation because of a single instance, and then wait until there's multiple instances and then ask for the revocation, putting them all together. But probably somebody from ACA can speak more to the statistics on it. My final point was this was really trying to find some common ground where we can all agree that we don't want a single instance of these low-level violations to result in somebody being, result in somebody losing their probation status. But I will turn it over to somebody from MACAC to be able to maybe communicate that a little more clearly than I have as not a professional in this realm.
Let's give that a try, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hollins, I think that point you make about the lack of statistics, and I think Representative O'Neill, you said something very similar about the fact that we don't know for sure, and part of that stems from what I think you were driving at, Representative Hollins, which is that many of our agents don't file formal violations reports on the very first violation, and that is, I think, what is striking to me in this opportunity we have to formalize that sort of standard. It is the way in which we operate most often. And so by the time a formal violation report is filed, it is generally not someone's first violation because of the work that our agents do with those clients to address those underlying issues on the front end.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if Commissioner Schnell is still on the line because he really has a lot of information and a lot of facts. And he and I have talked about this quite a lot, as you can imagine. I'm just wondering if he could offer some advice.
Sure. Let's see if he's still here, Commissioner. He may not be here. Is there anyone from the Department of Corrections? I know they're back and forth between this and another hearing. All right, let's see if they do pop up a little bit later, we can get to your inquiry. But you may have some other inquiry or points that you wish to emphasize.
Just again about the path in the Senate. It was just introduced, I believe, on the 17th, 2 days ago in the Senate. And, you know, we are at second deadline. And so my concern is if you're going to be sending this out of our committee, I think it's going to Judiciary, which is an appropriate place. They can really deal with, you know, ordering the court to do or not do something. I'd love to hear what they have to say about that. But I don't know, is the path then, Mr. Chair, to come back and maybe be in your omnibus so that it wouldn't be as much a, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because I would just be concerned that we'd have this conversation here and then it wouldn't really go anywhere because it just got introduced in the Senate side. I only bring this up again because we're at second deadline. Okay, I think short of having some information from DOC, it would have been nice to have them testify to this because, again, in my many years of doing this, I don't really think that the first violators really do get, you know, have their conditional release or probation revoked. They aren't revoked typically. I've never heard of a case in my studies, but, you know, maybe there are some. I just think maybe that a different approach might be a little bit more helpful than this approach. Just my suggestion.
Yeah, let me ask staff to keep tabs of our DLC folks. If they're aware when they show up, we can pull them in. I do see Ms. Stark, I think, wants to respond. Ms. Carly Stark?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative O'Neill, I just wanted to say that one reason that the DOC probably is not testifying on this, or that we didn't reach out to them, is because this doesn't relate to supervised release revocation, which is what they mostly deal with through their hearings and release unit. So they won't have the data on the majority of cases because that's county data. So counties supervise 80 through the two county systems, 83% of individuals in the state. So though DOC has the data housed within them, they may not have the reports pulled to know how that works or what the numbers say.
Very well.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative O'Neill.
I'm sorry. It's just it was such a big DE that I'm still trying to make my way through it. But if the author could just let me know exactly which violators. So are you, like she said, it wasn't conditional release. And so what does this cover to the author?
Representative Collins.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for that question, Representative O'Neill. This covers individuals who are directly placed on probation, so not folks who are on conditional release, but just folks who did not go to prison, had a stay, and then are on probation. So it's very limited, and part of the reason is because we're working with so many different stakeholders trying to find that common ground where we can all agree on something.
Very well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now I've got it. Thank you. That makes more sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Johnson. And I'm sorry, Representative Johnson. I'm sorry. I apologize. I do see Mr. Cooley, I think, wanted to comment on this last point. Mr. Cooley?
Very briefly, Robina Institute has been working on this in Ramsey County, I believe. And so, Representative O'Neill, I will make sure you get that data. I think what they found, though, is it is happening on a first violation more than we would like to think, although it might be in regards to what Ms. Johnson said about people not filing and then sending someone back, which I think we need to do. We need to have these filed because that adds legitimacy to the process, and so everyone is on the same page when they are sent back. And so I think this bill could be very helpful in adding that legitimacy, which is so important.
Helpful. Thank you, Mr. Cooley. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani. Representative Holland, I understand the what you're trying to do here, and I agree with a number of things in here. I do know working with probation officers in the past, one violation does not send them back. Two usually doesn't, unless they're serious violations. Three or four might get them to see the judge, and so on. But I do have on page four on section B, trying to find it again. I lost that section that I was reading.
Probably section four. That's the last section, and that's on page four, three and four.
It wasn't section four. It was
14.
It dealt where a person. There it is. Yeah, may not section 4.14 to 4.21 section B. Where it says that the court may not direct the person to be taken into immediate custody unless the court receives a written report signed under penalty of perjury pursuant to section showing probable cause that person violated probation and so forth. And a continued presence in the community via a potential risk to the public. My concern is if there are risks to the public, do we have to wait 3-4 days to get to court to get that person off the street? If there are risks to the public, they should not be on the street immediately and get them into court. So I do have a problem with that section. I think it needs to be worked on. Because if somebody's a danger to the public, we can't have them out there. It's a public safety issue. I understand all the other technical violations, but I think you should also have some other circumstances involved, a person might lose his job because of layoffs or something like that, no longer have an employment. But you also have to look at what was caused the dismissal from employment. Was it a layoff? Did they do something that was dangerous to somebody else? Were they threatening to other employees? Was involved in a theft issue? So I think we need to look at it more, a little more clearly, a little more focused. Do we want them to go in on the first minor violation? Absolutely not. But if they're extenuating circumstances to that violation, they need to be able to look at that. And I do hope this is going to judiciary where we can see it again. But I also have an issue on which Representative O'Neill brought up. The court is a separate branch of government, and I don't believe we have the authority to tell them what they can and can't do. That would be their judicial rules. So that's something that needs to be worked on. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I do see, Representative Hollins, that Ms. Christensen wanted to, I think, comment on this. Is that okay with you, Representative Hollins? Ms. Christensen, please identify yourself and a brief response.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Yes, this is Midge Christensen, 6 West Community Corrections, and I'm also a MACAC legislative co-chair. Representative Johnson, to your concern about the immediate detention issue, we also had that concern in working with the author, Representative Hollins. And if you note on line 1.24, this does still allow under 609.14 that corrections agents can hold someone that they believe is a risk to public safety under their own authority for that immediate safety issue. To be followed by the violation report that is noted later. So we as a association, at least in speaking on behalf of MACAC, we were assured and we feel comfortable that we do still have the ability to intervene in those immediate public safety risk situations. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Christensen. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to express my support for Representative Holland's bill and for, I think this is a really important issue to try to help reduce revocations. And we know that they should be a last resort, but we, I think, also know that unfortunately, too often they're not. And I think this bill will help us move in the right direction. Mr. Cooley brought up the Robina Institute work that they were doing with Ramsey County, and our bipartisan criminal justice reform caucus heard just this week from Robina Institute on that work. And I think that one of the interesting things they noted is that with the pandemic, there have been a lot fewer, they've been trying very hard to avoid sending folks to prison to the extent that they can, and that they've been very creative and worked really hard to try to keep people out of prison. And that I think lesson has shown that there are alternatives for a lot of folks in a lot of circumstances to revocations and to prison. And so maybe that's one good thing that can come out of this past year, is that we know that when folks put their mind to it, that we can avoid revocations, can avoid putting people back in prison to the extent possible. And so just wanted to thank Representative Hollins for her good work.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Long. Representative Botney.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Thank you, Representative Hollins, for bringing this forward. And it sounds like you're willing to, you know, do some tweaks, and I hope we can do that. I think the important thing of this bill is that we make sure that the people that are on this low level of probation, don't let that fear of being revoked keep them from seeking out help in the situations if they're the victim or reporting a crime against them. So for that reason, I will be in favor of it, because I want to make sure there's not that block between someone seeking help, or if, like I said, they're a victim, I want them to be able to reach out, or a medical situation or anything where they would come in contact with police, that or even if they're a witness. I've had situations where that has come up. I've had a great working relationship in the past with the probation officers, like Representative Johnson had mentioned. They're good people and they've got a good heart. And if, as long as we just codify that and we don't overreach, I'll be in favor of this.
Very well, thank you, Representative Omni. Representative Johnson, then we're gonna move to a vote.
I do agree with a lot of things in this bill. I would suggest that Representative Hollins, when it goes before it gets to judiciary, will deal with that issue with the conflicting statutes between the Section 1 and Section 4. When they're conflicting like that, I think it needs to be clarified a little better.
All right. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Hollins, last quick brief words of wisdom, and then we'll move to a vote.
I'll be very quick. I just want to thank the committee and thank you, Mr. Chair, for this great discussion. I want to thank the testifiers for their time and energy on this and the work that we've all put into it. And I also want to give a big thanks to Ben Johnson, House Research, who has been helping us to draft this and work with all the stakeholders. He's been amazing. So with that, I would ask for your support, and I renew my motion.
Very well. Ben Johnson's pretty good. Not bad. All right. Representative Hollins renews her motion that House File 1761, as amended, be referred to the Judiciary Committee. Your clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, aye. Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt.
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, aye.
Representative Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Lucero, aye. Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller, aye. Representative Novotny.
Novotny, aye.
Representative Novotny, aye. Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, no, at this time.
Representative O'Neill, nay. Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
Aye.
Representative Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Zhang, excused. That concludes roll call with 17 ayes and one nay.
Okay, with 17 ayes and one nay, the motion prevails. And House File 1761, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Thank you, Representative Hollins. Members, we have about 20 minutes left. We have two bills. I think we can do this. House File 218, Representative Waldemont, welcome to the committee. You used to sort of be part of this committee as part of the Corrections Committee that used to sit in with us in the last session. So it's good to have you back with us. The chair will move to refer House File 218 to the Ways and Means Committee. Representative Waldemont, we're going to lay this over, so we're not going to spend a bunch of time on it. You do have an author's amendment, however, it's out of order because we didn't receive it in the time. It needed to be received, but we can deal with that at a future time. Representative Waldemont, your bill is before us, if you can tell us about it.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. It's good to be back in public safety, and I'm here this morning to present House File 218, which creates a competitive grant of $300,000 to a qualified non-governmental organization to assist inmates in finding meaningful employment after release from incarceration. My author's amendment that I would like, the language I would like your consideration of, simply adds a sentence saying that $300,000 will go from the general fund to the Department of Corrections. Just a small little clarification there. The reason I'm bringing this bill forward, Mr. Chair and members, is because one thing I'm hearing a lot about, that I remember hearing about through my role as vice chair of the Corrections Subcommittee and what I'm seeing back home in my district, is that a lack of employment is a significant factor to recidivism. So I'm bringing this bill forward as a way to take action on helping inmates get meaningful employment upon release from prison. When individuals do not reoffend, it makes our communities and our entire state safer. And Mr. Chair, I know that's a goal that you want and that all the members of your committee want. I ask for your support for this bill, and I have a couple of testifiers who are here today to explain what this competitive grant could mean for them and for all of Minnesotans.
Very well. Thank you for bringing us a good bill, Representative Waldemont. We do have Dwight Tostenson and then Joshua Hedquist. If you can come forward, identify yourself for the record, and then give us preferably a brief testimony so we can move expeditiously through this. We greatly appreciate it. Let's start with Dwight Tostenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and representatives. My name is Dwight Tostenson, co-founder and CEO of the Redemption Project, here to speak in favor of House File 218. I will provide a brief description of our organization, which would be planned to apply for the grant established in this bill. The mission of the Redemption Project is to reduce recidivism. We do that by partnering with employers to provide inmates with mentoring opportunities while they're still incarcerated and meaningful employment upon their release. The population we serve is disproportionately people of color, underprivileged, and poorly educated, and many have addiction issues and other challenges to overcome. Our innovative three-phase approach includes educating, advocating, and supporting the population we serve. The first phase of our program is called Virtues for Success. It is a 14-week class that focuses on the development of good character, which is the internal thinking of a person versus the development of a moral code. We guide inmates through a curriculum that teaches them a new way of thinking of themselves and the way they perceive the world around them. The second phase is our inmate advocacy program, which begins with an extensive application that gives us a full background on each inmate. It includes a comprehensive criminal history, skills, training, goals, family dynamic, length of time served, time to release, and much, much more. We do this to ensure a good match with a mentor employment partner. We provide our mentor employers with a full background on their mentee, so there is no surprises for the employer in the future. This helps facilitate a job offer being made as the employer becomes comfortable with the inmate. We refer to this as a 12-month interview process for the employer. The Virtue Advantage is our third and final stage of our program. Here we use our relationships with other organizations to help inmates re-enter the community. The Redemption Project partners with other organizations to assist former inmates with issues like transportation, housing, education, addiction, and other matters. The cost per year of incarcerating a person in Minnesota is about $42,000. We can deliver our program for a one-time cost of approximately $2,500 per inmate. Our goal is to establish Minnesota as an innovative leader in reducing recidivism through employment, even during the COVID pandemic. We do not limit access to our program based on the crime committed, what security level the inmate is in, or the likelihood of their reoffending. Our criteria for being accepted into our program is solely based on an inmate's willingness to learn and change. Our organization was created 3 years ago and has been active in Minnesota federal prison system. And right before COVID hit, we were set to begin our program in the state system. We had to halt our program when prisons went into lockdown a year ago, but we hope to be back up and running soon. We have about 60 people at different stages in the program, and of those who have been released, not one of them has reoffended, which shows our model is different and truly works, which has provided us with the national attention from groups like Stand Together. With me today is Joshua Hedquist, an employment partner and mentor in our program, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Tostenson. Sounds like a powerful and meaningful program. Thank you for working it and doing it. All right, so we have Mr. Joshua Hedquist. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you can state your name for the record and give us a very brief testimony, we would appreciate it. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Joshua Hedquist, and I'm here to speak in favor of House File 218. Supporting efforts to reduce recidivism and provide inmates with curriculum and to connect meaningful employment is very personal to me. I was formerly incarcerated and a convicted felon, and I personally know how difficult and how challenging it can be to find meaningful employment, not just employment. I feel like the system's broken, and I want to help do whatever I can to fix this system. I heard about the mission that Tim and Dwight were doing, gravitated towards it, thought it was innovative and amazing. I connected with them and I became an employment partner. Currently, we have a fast casual style restaurant that we are using to give people opportunity with employment. I work with a gentleman named Daniel. He's one of our fellows, and he is on his way to owning his own restaurant. We're not employing dishwashers. We're not employing table wipers. We're employing people that are go-getters and hustlers and want to do the right thing and want to follow their dreams. The Redemption Project gives people hope, which we desperately need, my hometown of Minneapolis, in a positive direction. And opportunity begets opportunity, as we all know. And it begins with just one person, right? You know, Daniel will be a great role model in his community. And I think that this model works, and I hope you will support it. And I thank you for your time. I'm really excited about talking to everybody about what we're trying to do in this mission, this movement of systemic change in the incarceration system. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chef Joshua. We're really excited about this movement as well, and the role of people like you in it. And congratulations on your own journey towards success in our society and for giving back. Representative Johnson, quick comments, and then we're going to lay this over and then move to the next bill.
I'm sorry, I forgot to lower my hand.
Oh, okay, very well. Representative Wolgamott, very quick comments, and then, as I said, we're going to lay this over and take this up as a possible inclusion for our omnibus bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, for your time, and I hope that you will support this inclusion in your omnibus bill to give these folks a second chance and make sure that we keep all of our communities safer. Thank you very much.
Terrific, Bill. Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. With that, the chair lays over House File 218 for possible inclusion into the committee's omnibus bill. Thank you to all the testifiers. Very well. Our last bill is House File 128, Representative Novotny. Representative Novotny moves to refer House File 128 to the Committee on Ways and Means. And Representative Novotny, we're going to be moving to lay this over as well for possible inclusion. Your bill is before us. Tell us about it.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. House File 128 is a bill that adds language to the public arrest data section of the data practices statute. That's in 13.82. Subdivision 2 requires that the identity of the person or entity that posts the bill or bonds for the person held in jail be recorded and publicly available. The bill also requires that when a court accepts bail for payment for bail, a surety bond, a corporate bond, or recognizance, the court must notify the agency holding the suspect in custody that the money has been posted. The amount posted and the identity of the person or identity of the group that posts the bail. These crimes are, we've modified the bill over several submissions. This is a bill that relates to crimes of violence. It specifically eliminated any crimes that would be in First Amendment crimes related to expression of First Amendment. This does not apply to unlawful assemblies. This does not apply to impeding traffic crimes. Once again, it's restricted to the crimes described in state statutes as crimes of violence. We want to be able to track this. As I've found so many of the things when I'm doing research into this, where we see the disparities, just like in probation, it's very hard to get the data. Right now, if a person is given bail, it's very hard to find what the bail is and who posts the bail. And until the case is closed, it's not even searchable. So if someone wants to know right now who posted bail to get their, who perpetrated a crime against them out of jail, you have to physically go down to the courthouse and open the file to find out who that is. And this was brought to my attention last fall, or last summer, I guess, after a Channel 9 story that was on it. But for me, it really clicked in some things like who pays the bail? Because that bail becomes, by state statute, the possession of the person who the bail was posted for. So doing some investigations while I was working in the jail, there's a lot of money that can go back and forth. You know, some of these bails are talking about $100,000 that would automatically become possession of this next person, you know, whoever it's given to. So that's my look. We just want to be able to track that and make that publicly available. It's information that's already potentially there. It's just in a file, but you can't look it up. I submit the questions.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Novotny. Thank you for working diligently on this bill. We've been talking about it for a little while. We do have a public testifier. We actually have two. Julia Decker from ACLU, then Jared Malenkoff. I'm going to ask both of you to be very, very brief. We do have a comment or question for Representative Frazier. I want to get to that. And try to beat the clock here before we're kicked off of Zoom. Ms. Decker, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record. Give us your quick testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Julia Decker, Policy Director for the ACLU of Minnesota. ACLU of Minnesota really urges this committee to focus its attention on reforming the underlying problems with Minnesota's unfair bail system. Scrutinizing the source of a person's bail money just ignores the fundamental flaw with cash bail, which is that people who can afford to pay bail are not inherently more or less likely to commit an offense upon release. They simply have more money. And courts, not the payers of bail, are the ones who assess the factors in assigning that bail. Payment of that bail is simply a question of money. Furthermore, we remind the committee that people charged with the crime, regardless of the severity of the charge, are innocent until proven guilty. And as long as decision makers continue to associate ability to pay court-assessed bail with risk or danger to the public, we will continue to have an inequitable legal system that criminalizes people simply for being poor. So we urge this committee to focus its efforts on comprehensive bail reform rather than bills like House File 128. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Decker. Next we have Jared Mullenkoff of the Minnesota Freedom Fund. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your quick testimony as well. Welcome. I'm not hearing or seeing. Let's give it a second. All right, why don't we move to Representative Frazier, and then if Mr. Mullenkoff is able to join in, we'll patch him through. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Novotny, thank you for bringing the bill. Thank you for your description. Can you, Representative Novotny, can you tell me what does this bill fix?
Sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Representative Novotny, can you tell me what this bill fixes? What does it fix?
Representative Novotny.
Well, as I said in the test, thank you for the question, Representative Frazier. It fixes the inability to be able to search that data. Data is how we're going to find out if there are the disparities that we talk about. And if there are, how do we fix that? Are there judges that give preference to different people based on who's providing the bail? That's how we're going to find this out. And like I said, until the case is closed, it's not something that's searchable.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Novotny, so the way the process works, say an individual, if they're representing themselves, makes the argument to the judge for the bail, or the lawyer makes the argument to the judge for the bail based on the circumstances of that particular individual. So I'm not sure how this will collect any data to determine whether or not the judge is making a decision based on who's going to post the bail, when initially the judge doesn't know who's going to post that bail. They're making a decision based on what they believe are factors to determine whether or not that individual should have bail or not. So I'm still not clear of what this bill is going to solve. The data you're looking for is largely in part, you're going to find that data by just taking a look at who gets bail, who's offered bail, and who's not offered bail in terms of at the bail hearing. And that data is already available.
Representative Ivey?
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Representative Frazier, I agree that bail is available. That information is available if you're willing to go down and go through the files manually. If this is placed on the arrest data, as this bill would do, then it'd be able to search without physically going down and going through the files. And, it's a big state, as Chair Mariani has stated several times. If a crime is going up in Bemidji and a subject's been in custody down in Minneapolis, as has happened, then you wouldn't have to physically make that trip down to find out who posted that bail.
Members, this raises a question. It's not the bill, but it is a question I just want to put out there. We won't have time to dig into it. And that has to do whether or not we have data on patterns of bail decisions on the part of our judges. I don't know if that's data that exists anywhere, whether there's use in terms of collecting that kind of data to make some kind of assertion of what influences particular judges relative to their decisions. But that's not this bill, but I just want to put it out there. I think we may have Mr. Mullenkoff with us. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. Thank you
so much. Welcome to the committee. We only have a couple minutes, but please give us your name and give us your testimony. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for your time. My name is Jared Mullenkoff. I serve on the board of the Minnesota Freedom Fund, which is a charitable bail fund that works to address some of the inequities within our bail system, holding people in custody exclusively because they do not have the ability to pay their bail. We are here in response to this bill in opposition, and we would join Representative Frazier in raising concerns about whether or not this bill serves a meaningful purpose. Furthermore, I think that this committee should be concerned when looking at questions of bail reform to address matters that, you know, we have grave inequities in our system around cash bail and around the holding of people who don't have the financial resources to get released. This does not address any of those concerns. This is not a measure to reform bail. And I think that the committee should be concerned that in a lot of instances, so while I serve on the board of the Minnesota Freedom Fund, I'm also a public defender by day. And so I'm very familiar with how in practice this operates. And in domestic violence cases, if the information of people that post bail is searchable, in a lot of domestic violence cases, family members are posting the bail. A lot of times, alleged victims are posting the bail. And so what that will mean is that the alleged victims in domestic violence cases will have their information searchable, including by the person that they bailed out, who they may want to have bailed out but may not want to have contact with or to have their information available to them. And so I think that this is a bill in search of a problem, and I think that the reality is that it would create far more issues than it seeks to address, and I would suggest that it not be supported.
All right, very well. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Malenkoff, and for your testimony. Representative Votney, we're going to lay this over, but I'm going to give you the last word on this.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Mariani, and Representative Frazier. Thank you for bringing up these issues. This bill does not change anything as far as who gets bail. It doesn't change anything as far as when bail is available. I would be willing to entertain working with you, Representative Frazier, on modifications of the bail system. As said, I believe that the bail system should not be used to punish. It should only be used to secure appearance and compliance with conditions of court. And like I said, having that, all this does is make data available and searchable. And like I said, I made several changes to make it in those crimes of violence that we should know, should be able to find out. And, I understand the concerns with the domestic policies, but nothing in that the domestic relationships. I've been on the cases where they, the person that had their spouse or loved one arrested in a domestic, they've maintained contact or want them to at least be released so they can get to work. I understand that. That doesn't compromise that case on that end. I've heard that argument from Minnesota Freedom Fund before, and I don't think it holds up, but said it's just a data bill. It doesn't change anything, and I would be willing to work in the future on things that would make them equitable, but we have to know where that information is and how to fix it to start with. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Navadi, and I'm looking forward to you and Representative Frazier working on modification of the bail system. That's really, we can get good bipartisan work on a number of issues, we can accomplish so much. Representative Frazier, you wanted to say something quickly?
Yeah, I was going to say, Representative Navadi, I was just sending you a text. I know we've got to get a call in, so I'm looking forward to working with you on this. We can add that to the list of things you talk about.
All right, very well. The chair then lays over House File 128 for possible inclusion in the committee's omnibus bill. Members, that concludes our business for today. Just another quick reminder, next Friday is going to be a little bit longer. So please make sure your calendar is free through that 2:30 hour. I will work very hard not to get us all the way to 2:30. We'll try to complete sooner. We'll have a number of bills before us, as well as the budget requests of the Department of Public Safety and Department of Corrections before us. And I think some other boards as well, perhaps. And so with that, members, have a safe, wonderful, hopefully spring weekend. And we'll see you all next week. This committee stands adjourned.